Game on 2FM.
With Gillette. Great performances begin with a comfortable close shave from Gillette. Gillette, making men's lives just that little bit easier.
Game on 2FM.
With Gillette. New SkinGuard Sensitive Razor. The first razor of its kind designed to stop irritation on sensitive skin. Gillette, the best a man can get.
It's Thursday, the 23rd of January.
Coming up today, no repeat of Finn Russell's Six Nations heroics for Scotland this year after he's sent home from training camp.
Oh, in goes Russell, and he's away, and all of a sudden, we're going to be level.
The FAI confirm a famous name for a senior role.
And Zion Williamson makes a record-breaking NBA debut.
Zion for 4 for 4! Welcome to the NBA!
Game on 2FM.
All that and much more between now and 8 o'clock. Text us on 51552 or tweet at GameOn2FM. It's been a busy day, Marie, a lot going on.
Yeah, it really has. And I suppose it was... News, breaking news. We always like a bit of breaking news and the breaking. I do love it.
You love a breaking news. And do you know what? It drives me nuts because I'm not like you with the preparation for homework, but you have like piles of it. Now I have a few papers and stuff like that. But then it's like, oh no, I have to do all this work on Niall Quinn.
Well, you've 94 caps for Ireland, so you're doing all right. So the news today is that former Republic of Ireland striker Niall Quinn has been appointed as Deputy Chief Executive of the Football Association of Ireland. Mark Tighe from the Sunday Times joins us. Mark, welcome to Game On. Was this an appointment that was expected?
No, I don't think it was. We've just had the FAI appoint an interim CEO, Gary Owens, last week. That was something, I suppose, the position was available. We had Paul Cook, the vice president, a former Waterford delegate, you know, and someone who's from the newspaper industry. He'd been filling in there temporarily as they're trying to get someone to work, you know, full time, and he was doing that unpaid. So it was known that they were looking for an executive to lead the management team in the FAI. So once Gary Owens is brought in, I don't think people expect us all of a sudden we'll have a deputy CEO as well, and someone as high profile as Niall Quinn, who'd, you know, ruled himself out as going for the board or going for the chief executive position. So yeah, so somewhat of a surprise. But then if you look at the people that have come into the FAI in the last few weeks, we've had Roy Barrett from Goodbody Stockbrokers appointed as the first independent chairperson of the FAI. And we had Gary Owens, obviously, as a new CEO on an interim basis. Both of these people were members of the Niall Quinn Visionary Group, as it was called, who put out proposals last year about reforming how football was run in Ireland. And so it's kind of like a reverse takeover of the FAI here. So, you know, that group have been knocking on the FAI's door for some time now and kind of been getting the cold shoulder. And then with all the turmoil and the scandal and the financial crisis in the FAI, we've had the FAI do basically turn to that group en masse, it seems now, and they have the levers of power.
Well, Niall has been out speaking to the media. He was on Virgin Media. We're just going to hear from him now.
It is interim and it is for a short period of time, we believe. But in that period of time, it's very important that a strategy is developed in those pillars that everybody is feeding into and everybody feels it's the correct thing, so that whoever comes afterwards and whenever they come, that they're not starting all over again. I've stepped over the line because I believe it will be good and it'll be good enough. That's not that I know any of the figures involved. I don't know where it will end up when it finally is announced. I hope it's announced very, very soon. But I'm led to believe that there is an assistance in place from the three stakeholders, the banks, UEFA and the government, that will allow the game to move forward. It's a difficult time for staff, I know, but I'll be hopefully meeting up with everybody on Monday and trying to instill a bit more confidence in the system that, you know, that it's not as bleak as some of the pictures that were painted and that there is a growth pattern there envisaged for us to all be part of. Right now, it's still in that stage of not sure where we're going, but I would ask that they understand that a lot has been done to ease the pain. Gary and I got put back in our box a little bit to say, well, you have to be held accountable. So for a fraction of what the old gang, and I mean a fraction of what the old gang were at, it's there. But I deferred mine. Let's see how the redundancies work out, and let's see where the where the association gets to before I take mine.
That was Niall Quinn speaking to Virgin Media earlier. Mark Tighe from the Sunday Times is with us on the line. Mark, he said he's going to develop a strategy. Do you think that's going to be the visionary document that he had presented in the past?
Well, I'd hope it would have a bit more meat on the bones than that document. That was very aspirational, a lot of kind of jargon, business jargon in it. We need a lot more solid detail. Like where the FAR I now, and there's going to be a meeting next week of Kieran Lucid's group on this All-Ireland League strategy. So Niall Quinn is, from what I understand, he's going to take a lead also on, you know, developing the League of Ireland. That is a crucial, going to be a crucial part of how the FAI goes forward. So he's going to have to get his hands dirty. But also, I think where he will be a great benefit to the FAI is attracting new sponsors, because there has been a flight of sponsors. And they are the second biggest driver of revenue in the FAI after the TV money from UEFA. So, you know, we've had three say they're not going to sign on. And so I think if the FAI will clearly look for a blue chip company to come in and, you know, be the lead kind of title sponsor for the FAI. And someone having someone like Niall Quinn in there, I think he will add assurance to, you know, these companies, say we can trust the FAI now. We have someone like Niall Quinn in there as a kind of a face for it. And I think that will help them to bring in that desperately needed revenue, which is obviously a vital part of keeping them above board. Like, there will be job cuts up coming down the line, or that'll be widely speculated as for a company that's, you know, what the FAI is a limited company and has debts, huge debts of over 60 million euros. So it seems inevitable that they'll have to cut their cloth and cut back on some of the expenditure there, and that will include jobs.
Mark, you mentioned it, you know, being attractive to sponsors, but what will be the sentiment from grassroots level? Is this a good move for grassroots football in the FAI?
Well, I suppose, look, you have to give Niall Quinn the benefit of the doubt here. You know, he's willing to go in now, roll up the sleeves and get his hands dirty. So I think there'll be a wait and see approach from the grassroots, but also, you know, a willingness to go in now. You know, he has his hands on the levers of power now. So, you know, he'll have to make a lot of decisions. There's so much going on in junior football. You know, there's fights about, you know, teams in junior football in Leinster, you know, leaving certain leagues to join the Leinster Senior League, underage football, you know, the calendar year, you know, whether it should be stuck on that calendar year, the reforms that Ruud Dochter wants to bring in. So, you know, Niall Quinn will have to get involved in all these, you know, disputes, which, you know, are bitterly being fought on a base level, and try to encourage more people to keep playing the game of football, keep those numbers up. You know, football is still the most widely played sport in the country. So he's going to have to go in and try and look at those structures. Like, the structures in Irish football are, you know, I know someone that came in from the Dutch game and said, you know, you couldn't actually design a system like that. It's so chaotic in many ways. So there's a lot to be done, you know, from the amateur game to the League of Ireland, and then even from a corporate sense to try and fix the FAI. So there's a huge amount of work to be done there, and that's before even thinking about the firefighting of getting, you know, an extension on their bank loans to stop them becoming insolvent.
So, Mark, what do you think should be the priority then for Niall Quinn when he takes up this role?
Well, he's deputy CEO. We have, you know, a chairperson that has come from Goodbody, and we have Gary Owens in there as well. So I think between Roy Barrett and Niall Quinn and Gary Owens, the main priority is clearly getting enough money there to pay the staff each month, and making sure that there's a business plan in place, that the bank will support them, that the government will support them. So that's by and far still the number one priority. Like Paul Cook talked about at the reconvened AGM in December, that they're damn close to the red zone, and, you know, dangers of liquidation and examinership. So getting that danger off the immediate agenda is definitely the priority for all those people.
He spoke about his salary and said he's going to be receiving a fraction of what has gone before him have received. But you mentioned there, like, just the difficulties that the FAI found themselves in. Do they need a deputy CEO?
Yeah, like, I think so. Like, there is so many different fires to put out. I think, you know, one of the major problems of the FAI under John Delaney was that everything had to go through John Delaney. You know, and we had weak chair people or presidents of the FAI who, you know, like Donal Conway has done a fairly good job since the crisis emerged. But I think he'd admit that before that, you know, John Delaney ran the show. And, you know, anyone that wanted anything done from the FAI had to go through John Delaney. So maybe having three people there who are all strong individuals, who all have different strengths and weaknesses and have different responsibilities, that's a good thing. So people, you know, can delegate and get work done. And as I said, there's so many different aspects of the game that need addressing. So, yeah, I think it's not a bad idea. They did have a deputy CEO in there before. But, you know, John Delaney was such a dominant figure that I don't think that role was used properly as it could have been or was allowed to be used. So, you know, I think Niall Quinn isn't going to be anybody else's man. You know, he will stand up and he'll be very public face. So I think it's a good thing that we have three strong personalities in there for the moment. And we'll have obviously a new president coming in this weekend with the with the EGM of the FAI. So we're going to have, and that's, it's before men because there's only two male candidates for that. But so it'll be interesting to see how the power dynamic plays out between all these four individuals now from this weekend on.
And to be fair to Niall Quinn, he did say that he won't be taking a salary just yet until everybody inside in the FAI is sorted out. So EGM, aside from the new president that will be elected, is there anything else significant on the agenda?
No, it's a one item EGM to get the new president. So it is a significant moment this weekend. We have Gerry McEnany going up against Martin Herity from Sligo. You know, so Donald Conway has been fighting fires, and I think he's done well in getting the independent directors in and you know, helping the FAI survive to where it is. But I think it was inevitable that he would have to step aside before his term finished. And will be the last board member. Donald Conway has been on that FAI board for over 15 years now. So it's a significant moment that the last board director from the John Delaney era will be stepping aside. So there will be a completely new regime in there. And I think, you know, Minister Shane Ross has been calling for that since last summer. So I think that's the final kind of hurdle in terms of, you know, Ross was saying that was a block on the government helping the FAI. So there should be no further blockage on that front. And it's just a matter of who takes on the proportion of risk, I suppose, in terms of guaranteeing the FAI's loans going forward, whether that's UEFA or the Irish government.
Mark, you mentioned it there. It's been firefighting up to this point, and that maybe in the public image has been a frustration. Do you think these kind of moves, a strong board, someone like Niall Quinn now in, will this start a confidence boost?
Yeah, I think it can. Obviously, we still haven't got this deal, so in terms of the finances, but if they can get that, and it's still a big if, I think, then they can start, you know, dealing with basic things. We have a match coming up in Slovakia for the men's national team, you know, and it could be a bit of a lifesaver for the FAI if Mick McCarthy can arrange that, you know, Ireland actually win that match and the subsequent match against either Northern Ireland or Bosnia. You know, financially that would be a godsend for the FAI to go north of €5 million to qualify and play these matches in Dublin. It would be amazing for the country. So, you know, it would be great for football fans to stop focusing on corporate governance and finance failures and you know, start talking excitedly again about Irish football with so many great young Irish players coming up at the moment. It would be fantastic to be able to focus on on-field matters for a change.
And Mark, did you ever think when your piece was published in the Sunday Times that we would move so far past where we were just only a little while ago?
No, I honestly didn't think it would be as quick. And, you know, it really snowballed from that, you know, St. Patrick's Day last year. You know, we had Sport Ireland and John Tracy, you know, and Minister Ross demanding answers from John Delaney and the FAI within a week. And we had this extraordinary position of the executive vice president created out in Gibraltar during Mick McCarthy's first match over there. And, you know, to go to a situation, if you look back at the year where people like Niall Quinn and the visionary group and others who are knocking on the FAI's door looking to help or, you know, cause change in Irish football, and they're being given the cold shoulder. And now they're in, you know, here we are in January 2020 and they've got the reins of power. They're working in there. So it's an extraordinary change in matters. And, you know, hopefully there can be a new dawn if they can sort out the finances.
Even having Niall Quinn now in management in the FAI, it does feel very, very significant. Mark Thigh of the Sunday Times, thanks so much for joining us.
Cheers, guys. 2 FM.
Game on 2FM.
With Gillette, new SkinGuard Sensitive Razor. The first razor of its kind designed to stop irritation on sensitive skin. Gillette, the best a man can get. Game on 2FM.
Welcome back to Game On. Okay, we're going to turn our attention to rugby. And Finn Russell has been left out of the Scottish training camp after a breach of team protocol. And to tell us more about this, we're joined by Tom English, chief sports writer with the BBC. Tom, what's going on?
well, we spent the day trying to figure this one out. He's left the squad. They're going to Spain next week. He's not going to be going to Spain, obviously. He won't be playing against Ireland. I doubt that he'll be playing against England in the second game. There seems to be a clash with Gregor Townsend. I don't know the ins and outs, but obviously a very serious clash because he's left. He's walked out. There's all sorts of rumours, all sorts of innuendo about what's happened here, and we'll probably stay away from that. I think the smoke will clear in the next few days, but there has been a testiness in the relationship between Gregor Townsend and Finn Russell, going back a little while. Went back to Twickenham certainly when they had a big difference of opinions at half time at Twickenham when Scotland were getting pummeled by England about tactical things. That was a bit of a barney between the two of them, and now it's kind of come to a head, and I think it came to a head on Sunday night. I believe that Gregor Townsend believed he'd fixed it, that he'd headed off the crisis, but that the following day Finn Russell said, no, I don't want to be a part of this. For how long that position lasts, I don't know, but I suspect Finn Russell has got an awful lot of making up to do, because I do believe that the rest of the squad are disagree with him on what's happened here.
Donica, you'll have to text your pal over in Racing to find out and let us know.
I've been on to him.
But it's a lot going on. And listen, I'm hearing stuff from both sides. As you can understand, it's hard to get to the truth when you're getting information from both camps.
Yeah, absolutely. And you could go around it and sensationalise it, but you know, within the camp, it's probably very, very different. Tom, what I'm interested in is, though, Finn Russell and Gregor Townsend, as players, are quite similar, aren't they? Like, they're both free spirits, but I am, you know, chatting to my Scottish teammates over the years, they always chat about how regimental Gregor is in the play. So is this something, someone like a free spirit like Finn Russell, like you spoke about, getting hammered by England and then him standing up and them coming back, do you think he's had enough?
No, I think there's an element of that. Certainly the contretemps at halftime at Twickenham, Gregor wanted the team to kick more. Finn says, look, we are kicking, but we're getting annihilated. And Gregor said, well, you need to kick better. And I think they almost threw the game plan out the window in the second half, and they went on and obviously pulled off a pretty sensational draw. I think, you know, you think Gregor was this maverick and Finn is this maverick and they should actually get on. Mm. But I think there has always been a frisson between them. Gregor does. I know he has a reputation for being, you know, off the cuff, playing super fast rugby, playing as you see it. He's actually not like that, yeah. Or it's not as much like that as people think he is. He is very much in control of things. He is very much the boss. I'm not saying he's Joe Schmidt in his control freakery, but there are elements of it. And I think if Finn Russell is told, right, you need to kick here, you can't run, you can't pass, Finn Russell will go against that, because Finn Russell just makes it up as he goes along.
Yeah. Tom, I think it's
a part of the clash.
I know in sport people say that no player is irreplaceable, but is Russell the one that comes very close to being irreplaceable?
He is, absolutely. Absolutely he is. Like, he is the guy that makes things happen. Now, he can be a weakness in the team, because if you get to him, and Ireland, you know, over the years have got to him numerous times, certainly in the World Cup, they got to him, played poorly that day. But when he's on song, he makes the team tick. And you look what they have in backup. Adam Hastings is very callow. He's talented, but he's callow. Playing well, but in, you know, Pro 14, you go up to test match level, you're starting with all that pressure as a starting 10 against Ireland in Dublin. Will he be able to handle that? Questionable. But the big problem is, if Adam Hastings gets injured after 10 minutes, who comes on? There isn't another 10. There isn't another 10. Mm. Unless they take Duncan Weir out of a cold storage with Worcester Warriors, and he hasn't played for Scotland in a long time, Dunners.
He'll do a job for you.
He'll do a job, absolutely. And listen, that's another thing. I think he should be in the squad. But anyway, that's another day's work.
He could be very soon.
he could be very soon. The next up after Adam Hastings is Rory Hutchinson, Northampton centre. He's not a 10. Mm. I mean, that's probably what you're looking at here. So it's not just that you're losing everything that Finn Russell brings. It means your backup to your current 10 Hastings is not a 10. And, and you're going into a Six Nations.
Yeah, just on it, Tom, is it a real big test for Stuart Hogg as a new captain? You always have these dynamics that go on in every changing room. Players that don't agree with types of play, but it's always self-police from the floor, and fellas will always pull guys in that mightn't agree with the game plan, but good leadership, good leaders that we've been surrounded with, pull guys up on that and keep guys like Finn Russell in line. I know he's new to the role, but if you ask for captaincy, you've got to be able to manage moments like this.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And I think Stuart Hogg has been... I've been talking to Gregor Townsend non-stop about since this blew up on Sunday. I believe Stuart Hogg is very much in Gregor Townsend's camp on this particular issue. You know, as you say, Finn Russell, Stuart Hogg has captained Scotland once, a defeat in Houston against America. So that's not a great record. Now he's going into the Six Nations and his best player is gone. One of the big issues here, and it's a very big issue for Stuart Hogg, is what do the players in the camp think about this? Do they think that Finn has been wronged, or do they think he has wronged Gregor Townsend and the rest of the squad? If they think Finn has been wronged, that's a big problem, isn't it? It's a big problem for Stuart Hogg as captain, and it's a big problem for the rest of the squad. If on the flip side, and I believe, I'm beginning to believe that it is the flip side, that the rest of the squad think, no, Finn, you've got this wrong, then I think they could rally round, they could, you know, circle the wagons.
When you take into account just the World Cup campaign and now this, how much pressure is Gregor Townsend on now heading into the Six Nations?
He'd be under significant pressure. You know, listen, the expectations in Scotland, within Scotland, would be low because they haven't achieved anything since 1999. I mean, the record in the Six Nations is appalling. So the Scottish fans don't expect a lot. But what they do expect is they expect the team to be competitive, not to be winning 3 and 4 games and competing for the title, but to be competitive in all their games. And they weren't competitive against Japan in the World Cup because I know they had rallied late, but they played themselves out of it in 50 minutes. They were appalling against Ireland. They were terrible for 40 minutes against England. They were very poor against France. You know, routinely Scotland are not competitive. Over the last couple of seasons, they haven't been competitive in these games. This is a test for Gregor Townsend. Not racking up the wins, obviously, but that's what everyone's going to be looking for. But to go to the wire with a chance of winning. I think everyone will agree that Ireland are a better team than Scotland. But the Scotland fans will say, okay, Ireland win, fair enough. But we want to push them close. We don't want the game to be over after 50 minutes.
Yeah.
You know, so that is the expectation that Gregor Townsend is going to have to live with.
And the big game everyone goes back to, and maybe it's the key point that's gone on here, is that English game where they did try to play Gregor Townsend's structure, and maybe he's right about inaccurate kicks, but when Finn Russell is playing with Rassing and they're playing this kind of, like you mentioned there, throwing the ball from all sorts, a real running type of game, I've heard it from the Scottish lads. Gregor Townsend wants the ball back in play in 8 seconds. He doesn't want to play any rugby from his own half. they don't even practice much scrummaging because they just channel one the ball all the time to get in and out and get in play. For someone like Finn Russell, that would be massively frustrating, wouldn't it?
I think it is, yeah. And it's frustrating. You look at, Finn Russell, he made a great call by moving to Racing, because not only does he have a Rolls-Royce club, he's playing behind a Rolls-Royce pack. And he's going forward in nearly every game that he plays.
And hangs around with Simon Sebo.
And hangs around. That's his penance. You know? That's the cross he has to bear by being at Racing. It's a big thing. I think he's seen at Racing in Paris, he has seen another side of rugby. And this whole new vista has been opened up to him. And I don't know if he's had his head turned, but certainly he's playing with a different quality of player at Racing than he is when he comes back to Scotland. And maybe that's frustrated him. Maybe the internal rules of the squad have annoyed him a little bit in this particular incident. But there's certainly... I absolutely believe that Finn Russell is passionate about playing for Scotland. Absolutely passionate. But I also think that maybe his head might not be in the right place just now.
Tom, this is kind of unheard of in rugby. I can't remember anyone being sent away for a breach of team protocols. The closest I've come to it was Malcolm O'Kelly and Anthony Horgan in Lanzarote.
They turned up late or something.
They turned up for their training session, and then it was a weight session, and then they kind of like checked in, made sure the strength and the conditioning saw them, and then tore away back to their bedrooms and hid and went. When Liam Hennessy
drink might have been involved.
There could have been a small bit. But when Liam Hennessy knocked on the door, the two of them tried to hide in a tiny little wardrobe. Malcolm O'Kelly at 6'8", right in front of him. So this is what it would be a brilliant story to hear back that maybe Finn Russell and Stuart Hogg were probably at the same thing.
I can imagine Hennessy opening up the wardrobe doors and seeing big Mal squished in there. And Mal going, what's the story, buddy? I don't think the Russell one is quite as comical as that one. But it's certainly, I don't want to overly dramatise it, but it is Scottish rugby's Roy Keane in Saipan.
Yeah, fingers crossed.
You know, it's the biggest single kind of upfield story. And possibly biggest single on-field story that's happened in Scottish rugby in possibly 20 years.
Yeah, well, let's hope.
Their star man walking out and nobody knows when he's coming back. That's the thing, Gunners, you know. Nobody knows when he's coming back.
Simon Zeebo does.
get Zeebs on the phone and he can enlighten me.
Sort it out, Gunners, come on.
I have a big column to write for the BBC. So tell him to give me a shout.
Tom English, as always, thanks very much for joining us. We're going to take a quick break.
FM. Game on 2FM.
With Gillette, new skin guard sensitive with unique skin guard technology, taking the pressure off the blades and your shave. Say bye to shave irritation. Gillette, the best a man can get. Game on 2FM.
Okay, to GA now, we're delighted to be joined by broadcaster and journalist Damien Lawler. Damien, how are you?
I'm grand, Donica. How are you?
I'm very good. I know there's a lot going on with all the leagues starting up this weekend, but can we kind of focus on Division 3, Damien? Because, as you were telling us earlier on, this is, there's no room for error at this level.
Oh, thank God you asked me. I thought there was another Dancing with the Stars question coming there, Donica.
I'm on the naughty step.
I was there. Can we start with Taggy Fogarty's latest display?
I'm chatting about it.
Yeah, I think I'll stick to Division 3 if that's all right. I was never as nervous in all my life. Anyway, Division 3 is crucial this year because the Tier 2 Championship will be decided on who is in Division 3 and 4 by the end of the league. And the two-tier championship got through pretty easily at Special Congress, but at ground level, an awful lot of people don't want to be near it. So there is a big onus on the GEA to market it properly, to promote it properly, to play games before major championship games, to have an all-star team, to have trips away, to have TV coverage and media coverage. And if that's the case, there might possibly be a buy-in to the competition. I would feel myself that for the Tier 2 championship to be a success, the winner should automatically go into a preliminary quarter-final for the championship proper in the same year. And I think it's possible, it's not going to happen now, but I think that would have maybe alleviated all doubts. So where are we at the moment? Maybe Division 3 and Division 4 counties, a lot of Division 4 counties are resigned to where they are. They know they won't be challenging for a qualifier run or Super 8s or anything like that. But look at the counties in Division 3, Donegal, your own county, Cork. 10 years ago, they were All-Ireland champions. How could they countenance being in a Tier 2 championship just a decade on? Tipperary, my own county, were in an All-Ireland semi-final just a few years ago. They wouldn't like to be in a Tier 2 championship either. Proud counties then, like Down and Derry, they will have aspirations. It's been probably going quite horribly wrong for them for the last few years, so they are where they are. Derry are trying to get back out of a rut. Schlochneil players will be looking to bounce back there quickly, but there are counties then like Leitrim and Offaly and Longford, and with all due respect to them, you know, they've been used to this territory for the last few years. So the point I'm trying to make here is, it is imperative for two counties to get out of there as quickly as they can and not have to contend with a Tier 2 championship this year. And that really means you can't drop points anywhere. It really means that you have to win your home games and you probably have to win your opening games as well. So I'd say never before have we seen a focus on Division 3 like there will be this time around.
Damien, let's start with your own county. Like, you've got a new manager coming in, David Power. You've Paddy Christie, who's in the backroom team. So straight away, you've got these two great football coaches. But where does style of football come into it when you think that they have to win every game to get out of it?
Great question. And, you know, for example, David Power would like to play attacking football. One of his other coaches then is Charlie McKeever, who has probably took a more defensive template over the last few years himself. Marie, he's been involved with the Tip Miners and Clonmel Commercials. So there's a kind of a, I mean, they're two friends or two grown-up men. They'll arrive at a kind of a compromise themselves there. I think they'll have to go for it with their home games. And I think, like, definitely against the likes of Cork and Down and Derry, they'll probably play maybe three, if not four, across the midfield area and try and pack their defence a little bit just to see can they get a grip in that game, a foothold. And from there, I think they'll be more positive and they'll break from the back. And I think any team that David Power sends out has an attacking flair to it anyway. But they play Down on at the weekend and they've brought the game to Clonmel, the heartland and the football in Tipperary. And that means they need a result, they want a result, and they want a crowd in there. Rather than being lost in Selma Stadium, Marie, where you might have maybe no more than 500 people at it. So that's a signal of intent. There's two or three Kilcoo players involved with Down and Quaylen Mooney. I don't think any of those will be involved. So that's a huge one for them. But take a county like Cork. Struggling with debt over the stadium. They've made huge strides. Conor Coonan is in charge of the footballing body down there. Brian Cuppert would have worked very, very hard. They're the reigning All-Ireland under-20 champions. There's huge work going on underage. I'm like a parrot saying that in the show every week. They'll want to get out of there, and now they should. But they won't want to be stuck in a Tier 2 championship. Not a county like them that lifted Sam Maguire just 10 years ago.
When you look at the team that they've named, though, for the Offaly game, they have gone quite young, like Goran O'Mahony flanking Kieran Sheehan, Powder's back, he's in the corner. So, like, they're not really going with the tried and trusted that you'd expect for a team that are going to be in a dogfight for the next few months. They're giving you the fling, like.
They are, Marie, and I think there's two reasons for that. They have some cracking young forwards coming up. I saw that myself firsthand under-20s. They have some cracking forwards there. And their defence hasn't been great for the last few years, so I think that's why you're seeing change there now as well. You know, they've been very disappointing. They've conceded an awful lot, and I think that they're going with the younger guys now and going to see what they're made of. And I think that I think the future is the youth there myself, and it's probably... Yeah, it's a risky one to be going at it for, but they've no choice. I mean, I think they obviously don't trust maybe the defence that system that they've had for the last few years, and they feel if they go with that, they'll be pierced in Division 3. So these young bucks coming in, they're used to winning, and I think they're banking on them hitting the ground running. But it is fascinating. Look at the tradition in Division 3. Cork, Down, Offaly and Derry. And I mean, Tipperary have been performing quite well the last few years too. Longford are a very, very steady team on their day. You know, so there's huge, and Louder they're in Leinster final not too long ago either. So I would argue that Division 3 is more competitive or tighter than Division 2 even.
Yeah, just sorry, no, I need the rebel in me needs to go back. But just to Cork there, Damien, and your view on giving young players a chance is one thing, but the pressure of you know, the league now for these guys to perform, is that an unnecessary pressure to put on these guys already, especially before we have even hit Championship?
It probably is a more severe pressure this year, Donegal, because of the Tier 2 net that's looming underneath them. But I would feel, so Ronan McCarthy knows his squad inside out now. I have to, honestly, in my own view, picture of Cork football is in its youth now. They're coming good at a lot of levels underage. And I probably traditionally would have argued probably a bit early for a lot of them to step up. But the harsh reality of the situation is a lot of these guys are walking away at 27, 28. Mm. So have you noticed that they're coming in nearly just maybe 18, 19 years of age? Look at David Clifford, captain of Kerry, on the week of his 21st birthday. So pressure is everywhere, unfortunately. Mm. And I feel that the management would recognise that their future is down to youth now. And obviously you need the experience too. Like, I mean, the likes of Paul Kerrigan has been an unbelievable servant and would be an unbelievable influence around that dressing room, and it can still do a job for Cork. But what I'm saying is, to backbone it, to strengthen up the defence and to play at a pace that will get them out of Division 3, I think it's the younger legs they're going to look to.
It's either that or else they're just really confident that they're going to beat Kerry in the Munster semi-final and be up in the tier 1 anyway, Damien.
That's a dig at the Cork lads.
Yeah, that would be unbelievable. Shots confidence, a stretch too far, I think.
So Damien, tomorrow we are going to have a
yeah,
big,
yeah.
We're going to do a big hurling preview. But just before we move on from the football, like, there is lower divisions in the hurling as well that we very, very rarely cover. And like, those teams that are down there trying to get out of it, what, like, not everyone is going to get up, but what are those teams trying to achieve from their league campaigns at this time of year?
Okay, so if you draw a line from Galway to Dublin, go right across the country, basically everybody else above that is struggling. And I don't mean to be kind of flippant by saying that, but that's the truth. If you look at a challenge, the Celtic Challenge competition, the under-17s, it's a 32-county competition. It's divided into about 6 or 7 tiers, and every county's playing at a level where they can actually progress and make progress. For example, there's a guy called Ronan Sheehan from Cork, up and down, doing unbelievable work there, and that's now starting to transfer to senior level. So what are you looking for? So take Westmeath. They're in Division 1 proper now, for example, and you know, they are really, really up against it. Shane O'Brien is the manager there. Cork, Galway, Limerick, Tipperary and Waterford are in their group. If they pinch one win there now, that's a success story. Division 2, Division 1B, shall we say, you've got Clare, Dublin, Kilkenny, but you also have Laois and Carlow there as well. And I think, in fairness, for anybody below them, to do a Laois or Carlow on it is as much as they can expect at the moment. In other words, to hold their own in Division 1... because the gap between 1B and 1A is absolutely colossal. And even the gap between 1B and 2A is big as well. So to go down to 2A, obviously if you're Michael Fennelly and you're the Offaly manager, there's only one way you want to get going this season. That's get up to Division 1B, get promotion, and to win the Christie Ring and try and stop the rot that has been kind of festering away in Offaly hurling for the last 14 years. Kerry would feel that they don't belong in 2A. They'll want to get out of there as well. Antrim, an absolute sleeping giant. You see, at club level, they can produce heroics, but at county level, they can't get it together at all. But Darren Gleeson's gone up there now from Tipperary. He's gone up as manager. They've had a little bit of good news with the fact that Casement Park is back on track again, potentially. And the Gaelfast movement is rejuvenating Gaelic games in Belfast City, which is kind of a graveyard for GAA over the last decade or so. So the point I'm trying to make here is every county has their own little goals, their own little targets. It's all relative to what's going on there. There's another county in 2A called Meath. And in hurling, they're not a known force, but at underage, they're going really, really well. And I suppose, Marie, a county I'd really pick out would be Kildare in Division 2B. David Herity, he took over last year, his first year in charge. They had just won the Christie Ring the year before. He got a late appointment. 16 players left straight away, because they had either committed too hard the previous years or they wanted to try something new, they wanted to go off travelling. he had an awful job trying to get together a squad. But he's brought in about 17 youngsters now this time around. A lot of them are from Naas, but he's got a spread of 7 or 8 clubs around that county as well. And mentioning Naas, they won everything in Kildare from under 14 right up to senior, including intermediate and junior, to win a clean sweep of hurling titles. And there's an absolute explosion of hurling going on in Kildare at the moment. And their target should be club level to win a Leinster senior title within 10 years. I'd be laughed at for saying that, but it can be done. And look what Mount Leinster Rangers have done. But as a county, just to make progress, I think they all want to get up to the Joe McDonagh Cup. That's a really good standard. There's a small bit of attention in that competition. They're really struggling for life outside of that, I'll be honest about it. The Christy Ring Cup has nearly been run off in 7 weeks in previous seasons, and you're not going to make a huge amount of progress there. It's getting from Ring up to McDonagh, getting support from Croke Park, getting more coaches into the county, and trying to spread hurling beyond the traditional 9 to 12 counties, Marie. So they all have their own goals.
And Damien, just staying on the hurling, just this evening we saw a clip shared on social media of Ozzie Gleeson playing Fitzgibbon hurling for WIT against Mary Eye, and it seemed that he sustained an injury. If he has, that would be a huge blow for his county.
Oh, it's a big blow. He was going well, Marie. He got a good few scores too. I actually thought it maybe it was the hamstring at first, but I think it's a knee injury now. That's a lot more worrying. Now, the WIT management laid fears to reporters afterwards that was a serious thing, but you know, there is a huge concern. The thing about Austin Gleeson was, he did an interview not so long ago, and he kind of surmised where he's at the moment. And the last couple of years were a worry for him because they've drifted away. And as we know, Young Hurler of the Year, the past Hurler of the Year, All-Star, we still don't know his best position. And I think the point he was making was he was really, really, really going to up his commitment and determination and application, probably more than anything, and knuckle down and try and get that position for himself, which is probably midfield or centre-back. But he's been moved everywhere for club, county and underage teams. And to see him hobbling off there now against LIT, that's a worrying sign, and Liam Cahill won't be happy with that. It just goes to show you all the games that are going on right now in the conditions as well. It's hard, but even for him to be playing in the league now, from what I saw today, will be a big thing. And Liam Cahill will want to hit that ground running. He'll want a partisan crowd in Walsh Park to host Cork on Sunday, and Austin Gleeson would have been a huge part of that, Marie.
Just on that, Damien, who picks up like the medical care for him now? Does that stay with the college, or does that go straight to Waterford? How will they assess him and see where he's at?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, he's on college duty there now, so like the college medics and medical team will be looking after him, and they'll have to foot that, because the county board will rightly argue it didn't happen on their watch. Now, having said all that, I would feel there'll be a huge liaison between the Waterford physio medical team and the college medical team, and the welfare of Austin Gleeson is paramount here. And I'd say it'll be huge consultation, but if you're asking me the basics of picking up a bill, I think it'll be the WIT GA department.
I'm not worried about just for his welfare and him being right. Of course, you know, we're starting to see it in more and more sports. When pressure comes on to get players on the pitch, you know, medics can be put under massive pressure as well.
I'd imagine it's whoever can give the best,
I think,
care.
As we mentioned, I think that's what will happen, Marie. Sorry, Donica, I misunderstood your question. I thought it was actually the basics of the nuts and bolts of this. What will happen is immediately the county board medics will be onto the college medical team, and there'll be a plan drawn up straight away, I suppose. A scan when the swelling goes down, and they go from there then. But you know, he's a prize jewel for Waterford hurling, and I'd say all parties have to combine. I think long term he'll have to be right for his county. That'll have to take precedence.
A story, I think, Damien, that gave everyone that is interested in GAA lift today was Pat Critchley. Just his heroics yesterday as a manager. I know everybody will be so familiar with him being such an all-star hurler, and then making his mark on the GAA all through his county niche.
Yeah.
But so he managed IT Carlow, and they're going to be in their very first Sigerson final after they beat Letterkenny IT in an absolute thriller. And earlier then, he had also coached his school, Scull Creased Rhee, to their first All-Ireland Under-19A basketball title.
Double jobbing.
he taught PE there for 32 years, and like, Pat Chrisley is just an incredible character. He's written two books, Hungry Hill, kind of a memoir of where he grew up and his sporting life, and then a more recent book called Bruno, a collection of short stories. You love this, Donica. He was in a band called Mere Mortals. They played in Fela. They were on the early bill. They were ahead of Van Morrison, about maybe 9 hours ahead of him, but they were on the same bill as him. A long time ago, I think he played Hurley guitar early on before he graduated. But he has an unbelievable backstory, Pat Chrisley does. He would have played basketball for Ireland only for the fact that he was a dual player for Port Laois, winning an All-Ireland title and hurling for Laois. Laois is only All-Star for the bones of 20 years or so. He's probably a coaching missionary, the way I'd put it. He taught English as well, among other things, and every year he got a class of first years in. He put up a quote on the PowerPoint or the blackboard or whiteboard or whatever it was, and the quote was basically that kids of today were spoiled, they were too used to luxuries, they didn't know the meaning of hard work, they didn't know the meaning of respect, and basically, you know, they were not a good class of people, young people. And he would always get frowns or disapproving looks from his students, but then he asked them to try and guess when that quote came about, and it went back to Socrates. And the point he was making was, there's always been a generation gap. There's always been a scenario where adults have looked down on kids and maybe not understood them. And he was making the point that, you know, just because people tell you can't do anything or because you're perceived to be a certain way, that doesn't mean it has to be. And the students loved him. And he will always maintain that most of his experiences in coaching, they've all been positive. Any negatives have nearly come from adults. So I think what he's done, he's brought Carlo, IT Carlo, to their first ever Sigerson final. I gave 4 years down there myself from replowing away with the hurlers, and at the time we had nothing. Like, I mean, we got to a Ryan Cup final, but the footballers were like the stars. They got nearly all the gear, all the sponsorship, but they still made no significant progress. To get them to a Sigerson Cup final is absolutely huge, and to do it a few hours after he guided the school to their first ever 19 basketball title, it just shows, like, all these years later he's still doing it, because he has the personal touch. He can actually deal with the human and the personal side of things.
And no doubt, in best singer on the bus home, Damien Lawler. We didn't get to chat about Aidan, but maybe next week. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, I'll actually watch the episode and be ready for you.
Thanks, Damien. You've got homework now. So just some breaking news, some very good news actually. Rhianna Jarrett, the Republic of Ireland international, has signed a 6-month deal with Brighton and Hove Albion. So that's brilliant, because with some crucial qualifiers coming up, the fact that she is playing football at that level will do so much for her development, because we've heard Vera Powell and other high-level coaches, Colin Bell before her, say how important it is that our women's players are playing overseas. Now, sticking with football, I am joined on the line by Ronan Murphy from Goal.com. Ronan, how are you?
No, not too bad. Yourself?
I'm good. Now, I was going to start with Ryan Johansson, but because we're talking about our Irish players and qualifiers, I'm going to start with Glenn Whelan. So, a bit like Rhianna, Glenn Whelan has a new club.
Yeah, it's not as impressive as Rhianna's, unfortunately. I've seen Rhianna a few times here in Wexford, and she's a fantastic footballer, and it's great to see. But Ben Whelan's, it's a bit of a step down for what we're used to for international footballers. He's gone to League One side Fleetwood Town, who are 11th in League One at the moment. So it's not really a good news story on his part, I don't think.
There was, he was struggling though, so at least he's got somewhere.
Yeah, well, that's true. It'll help his fitness if he is going to be included in the kind of crucial playoff matches we have in March. So it's good that he's going to be playing. But whether Mick McCarthy is going to want to call upon a player playing in the League One rather than perhaps maybe James McCarthy, who's in the Crystal Palace team at the moment, or Josh Cullen, who was back for Charlton last night, will be an interesting one to watch in the coming weeks and months. Anyway.
Ronan, how important is it for him, though, just to, like you're saying there, just to be playing ball? It's better than him sitting on his arse, isn't it?
Oh, it definitely is. It's good to see that he found a club so quickly after leaving Hearts, because the new manager came in at Hearts and he just really didn't have time for him, because I think he's trying to build a young team, and maybe Glenn is the wrong side of 30, and maybe he doesn't have the legs anymore for playing Scottish Premiership football and to try and keep them into Scottish Premiership. So I think it's a good move for him, and it'll give him a chance. And I think he'll actually really stand out in League One, because as we've seen for Ireland, he does have the talent. It's just maybe his fitness levels and his pace isn't what it once was.
And one player it looks like he won't be playing for Ireland is Johansson, because his agent has said that he will play with Sweden.
Yeah, unfortunately, that seems to be the case. I was talking to the Swedish journalist who broke the story in Sweden yesterday, and he was saying that he had met him in Seville, the agent. He's a Swede himself, so he was kind of pushing for Johansson to declare for Sweden. But from what I'm hearing from Johansson's camp is that the eligibility problems with FIFA, where his mother wasn't born in Ireland, and then that was causing problems with FIFA, and there was going to be an appeal and all. That seems to be the kind of the main problem for it, and it was too much hassle for Johansson, so he decided in the end that Sweden was the easiest, and because his dad is Swedish, he's just going to stick with Sweden, and it takes the hassle out of him, especially with him changing club at the moment to Sevilla, and that's going to be just the way forward. So he's probably going to be off my radar as someone who focuses on German football and Irish football. A Swedish player playing in Spain probably won't be as interesting to me anymore.
Yeah, absolutely. Ronan, as always, thanks very much for joining us. Last time we were chatting, we nearly made you late for the plane, so we leave you go early tonight. Thanks. We're going to take a quick break. 2FM.
Game on 2FM. With Gillette Skin Guard Sensitive. The first razor of its kind designed to stop skin irritation. Revolutionary technology. Taking the pressure off the blades and your shave. Gillette. The best a man can get. Game on 2FM.
Now, welcome back to Game On. Liverpool are, of course, taking on Wolves tonight as they continue on their relentless quest to claim the Premier League.
So smug. You're just loving rubbing it in every time.
Well, it's not as fun when Ruby isn't here, I have to say.
That's true. It'll be a tough one tonight, would it? Would you not think Wolves trying to get up to fifth?
No.
No? Oh, my goodness. It's brilliant.
There are no threats. Once Man City and Leicester are gone out of the way, everyone else, it's just a formality.
Can you remember a time when it was tough to be a Liverpool supporter? You can't even remember that anymore. The last 30 years, how tough it was.
No, I'm just all about the here and now. I'm living in the moment. We will have some team news on that very, very shortly. Just to stay with Liverpool, every time there are big Liverpool matches, Sean Cox does get remembered, and the incident that happened with him, and they have been very good to keep him in their thoughts as he continues his recovery. So there was good news today that at an event at the Three Arena to support injured Liverpool fan Sean Cox, £465,000 was raised for his rehabilitation trust. So over 8,000 people, including Sean, attended, and there was lots of comedians, John Bishop, who I've seen and I like very much, Michael McIntyre, Dara O'Brien, Deirdre O'Kane, Des Bishop, Jason Byrne, Joanne McNally and Tommy Tiernan, they all performed. So vital funds.
Yeah, that's brilliant when you see people reaching out and going away from, of course, a Liverpool supporter, but just people back home as well reaching out and helping them. 8,000 people, and that's a massive amount of money, which I'm sure will help massively for everything that's gone on with Sean Cox.
Yeah. So just on the team news, both sides are unchanged from their last games. So there was a bit of an expectation that Fabinho might start, but he is on the bench and so is Minamimo. So he might make his Premier League debut tonight. And then it's all the big guns, Salah, Firmino, Mane are up there, Van Dijk, Robertson, Henderson, Oxlade-Chamberlain.
Have you even looked at the Wolves team? You're not having it.
Doherty's there.
Oh, yes. But there's a few Irish, is there?
Just Doherty.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so he regularly plays for them. And in fairness, like, Wolves have beaten Man City twice this season, so maybe they will.
Yeah. Keep it somewhat fresh.
Yeah. Let's hear from both managers.
It's all about using your football skills and your attitude, your character, team play, individual skills, all that stuff in all the Premier League games. That's what we have to do. But being 1 point down, that we were that angry and thought next year we will catch them, nobody had an idea before the season if we can be even close to Man City or not, because they can make their next steps as well. So we thought about our next steps and try to do them, and that's how it is.
What we're going to do is prepare ourselves well, like we always do, and play the game. We have to compete well, we have to have the ball, we have to defend, we have to stay organized. We have to, our fans will be behind us, it will be a fantastic atmosphere, we have to enjoy the game.
Now Alex Winter is standing by for us at Molyneux. So we've heard the team news there, Alex, but I suppose the big question is, do you think that Wolves are a team that could trouble Liverpool tonight?
Well, I certainly hope so. Excuse me. Somebody's got to give Liverpool a game, haven't they, and try and end this incredible season they've been on. They come here 13 games, 13 wins on the spin, and talks of the invincible season that Arsenal conjured up a decade or so ago getting bigger and bigger, really. But for the moment, the fog here at Molyneux actually is getting thicker and thicker, being very steadily blown in, and visibility isn't perfect for the moment, but I think we're just about okay in seeing from one end of the pitch to the other, so no danger in terms of the game being delayed or anything like that. But Wolves are a side that they like to get forward with pace. They use their wing backs, Doherty on one side, and well, it'd probably be Saez on the other side tonight because Diogo Jota is coming back from injury and is only on the bench. But they do have the tools to get at the bigger sides in the Premier League. They've got a very, very good record against the top six. We see so many times Liverpool being able to dictate terms in matches. But if Wolves can get in the game in the first half, they do have a terrible record recently with conceding the first goal. They conceded first in the last seven matches, Wolves. If they can avoid that and gain a foothold in the game, then they've got the tools to do some damage to Liverpool and give them one or two things to think about.
Yeah, they're definitely teams that have clocked up a lot of miles. Is it Wolves' 40th game this season?
Yes, that's right. Yeah, it began way back in July with the Europa League qualifiers, always dubbed as the poison chalice. You qualify for Europe and you end up with this mammoth fixture list that the manager Nuno Espirito Santo had plenty to say about over the Christmas period, where the games just didn't stop for Wolves, and as such they've been been trying to be busy in the transfer market this January to get some extra bodies in. But you're right, yeah, 40 games for Wolves in total so far this season. Liverpool themselves have had a big schedule with their trip out to the Club World Cup and their runs in the cup competitions as well domestically. So they're on their 37th match this season as well. So both sides, as you say, got plenty of miles in their legs.
Do you think we might see Minamino get on?
Who knows? Who knows? One of the new bodies brought in, big reputation in from the continent, is an option tonight for Jurgen Klopp, certainly. Nice to see the youngsters. Also, Curtis Jones giving his chance on the bench as well for Liverpool. So if the game perhaps is secure, then we maybe could see one or two changes in the second half. But the job to do for Liverpool, of course, is to get the 3 points secure before then.
Marie's just asking because she's after buying his new jersey, ready to go out of the pack.
When I was in Qatar, he'd just been announced as a new signing, and there was people there with Minamino jerseys already. So a lot of people ahead of me.
Got to be done, indeed, yeah.
What will he add?
Chopping up the coffers.
Yeah, what will he add?
Said again, the PA announcer struck up at just the wrong moment then.
What can he add? Obviously, Liverpool known for having a great squad, but, you know, having this type of firepower on your bench.
Oh, it's just more firepower, isn't it? The best sides have the stock fulls of firepower, and if you look at the opposite bench tonight, Wolves, you look on their bench and there's not too much to really scare you. The likes of the youngsters, Max Kilman, Benny Ashley Seal is on the bench, the youngster who started against Manchester United a few weeks ago here. Morgan Gibbs-White, very talented young player. Jota I've already mentioned, but nobody really there you look at and go, well, we'll be looking over our shoulders when the ball goes up for a substitution sometime perhaps in the second half. But that Liverpool bench, certainly much stronger. Fabinho, Minamino, you say there, Divock Origi, who came up with that huge goal, if you remember, at Newcastle towards the back end of the previous campaign. Just a few more tools there to give the opposition manager a bit more to think about.
Alex Winter over at Wolves versus Liverpool, thank you so much for joining us. We're going to take a quick break, and then Tony O'Donoghue has been speaking to Niall Quinn. Two. Now, it has been a day with more news from the FAI. Niall Quinn was appointed the interim deputy chief executive of the FAI and our soccer correspondent, Tony O'Donoghue, who has been speaking to him and joins us on the line. Tony, another day and another appointment.
Yeah, there's been quite a few now, hasn't there? I mean, we've had Gary Owens as the interim chief executive appointed Monday. Before that, Roy Barrett, the independent chair, the new independent chair of the Football Association of Ireland, and today Niall Quinn. And what do they have in common? Well, each of those were among the people involved in Niall Quinn's visionary group, his blueprint for the future of Irish football. And so Niall himself has been added to that list. He'll be welcomed by many because, you know, he's certainly seen as a man of great integrity. Played 92 times for Ireland, chairman of Sunderland. I mean, he knows the game. He's played at Manchester City and Arsenal in his prime. Knows the game well. Roy Keane famously once called him Mother Teresa, of course. And maybe his job now is to give hope to the hopeless, help the poor. The FAI cash strapped, of course. 18 million they need as an immediate cash injection. And a short time ago, I caught up with Niall for his vision in his new job as interim chief executive.
Now, the timing and even the title, first of all, interim deputy chief executive, for how long do you think you'll be in the role, and why did you decide to take it up now?
Well, I'm not sure how long it's going to last, but I do know there was a great need lately to try and haul the game back into some sense of shape that would make, you know, the stakeholders feel good about football again. So it's all very well, you know, speaking about it as I have done over the last 12 months. You know, I just felt that time was right now to go in and do something when offered, on the basis that two very good people have gone in before me in the last couple of weeks, and followed and joined by two great independent board members in, you know, Catherine and Liz, and I could see things getting better very quickly. And also, you know, I felt that the assistance that appears to be coming from UEFA, from the banks, and from government, of course, that seems to be going well enough to suggest that we'll have more than just survival on the agenda for the FAI from this point on, that we can actually get back to being what we're meant to be, and that serve football in every department as best we can.
But now, you did say that you didn't want to be CEO and you would step back. So, okay, you're not CEO. Gary Owens is the CEO. But why the change?
Because there's a lot of restructuring to do that somebody who has restructured businesses in the past would be much better at than I. That somebody has got strategies to put in at administrative level. And I felt that my best service to the FAI would be done through football and stuff surrounding football, not restructuring businesses that were in big trouble. You must remember how bad, of course, the business is. So this is a huge job to haul it back into shape from an administrative point of view. I just wanted to get on with helping the football side, and that's where it's panned out. So, you know, Gary Owens has restructured businesses from time to time. He's a fantastic track record. Roy Barrett and the independent directors will be great for the sitting board now to bring things to new levels, and I can get on and start to rebuild relationships through football that are sadly lacking now, as you know. And it was better for me not to have that responsibility of something that I'd never done before, and that's the restructure.
But the FAI immediately needs a cash injection of at least 18 million euros just to pay the wages. Why should anyone give the FAI money, considering what's happened to money in the past?
That's a very good question. And I think what we have to do is restore trust and credibility to show the Exchequer in the first instance here that coming in and saving the game is correct, because, you know, the Exchequer's money has to be seen to be going to the right places and doing the right things. We hope that this new look FAI will convince government that that's the correct thing to do. We hope that UEFA believe that as well, and we'll build those relationships and make them even stronger. And of course, you know, there's legacy problems, legacy issues, and the game is in big trouble. Let's not forget that. But I think if we can bring skill sets and, you know, an FAI that works great from the inside out. And what I mean by that is that if we can get it right inside the building at Abbottstown, and that people going into work each day there believe in what they're doing, are expanding their roles, are creating exactly what football is meant to do for people in all areas of Irish football, be it grassroots, you know, be it the amateur players, be it the player pathways for those at the higher level, and the elite game itself, League of Ireland. If we can pull it all together and show the value of football, I think we need to regain trust, credibility, and show what it means and what it can achieve if done correctly, and then maybe government will support us more. But I take your point, it's not simple.
The League of Ireland you mentioned there, and that's one of the big issues for your brief, as I understand it. But you haven't played League of Ireland, you haven't been associated with any particular League of Ireland club. I mean, what can you do for the League of Ireland?
Well, personally, I'm here to try and be something friendlier to the League of Ireland. I've said many times over the last 12 months that if we're to do anything proper about football in this country, we have to start at the elite game, and that is the League of Ireland. It needs to be treated better by the association. How that plays out now, obviously we're dependent on financial stakeholders to assist at this point, but I think where it can go is we can get a strongly unified League of Ireland, that they come together as one and make demands of the FAI, then we should be there to help them and assist them. We'll try and bring best practices in. Well, obviously we'll try and help financially too. Let's see what the art of the possible is there. But it's good that in the last year the League of Ireland has started to constitute itself. They are beginning to speak as one, because they had no voice at all till probably 7-8 months ago, when they realised they could stand up and be counted.
So what's your view of the All-Ireland League proposals?
If that's where the... Hello. How are you doing? My view of the All-Ireland proposal is, if that's what the League of Ireland clubs want when they come together as one, if they need assistance in bringing that through with the the IFA and the clubs up in the north, then we're here to help that. It really is them to you know, stand up and take responsibility for themselves now with help from us. I don't think we can go in and start ordering the FAI about like they used. The FAI should order the League of Ireland about like they used to. I think that day has changed. We're here to assist.
You had a group, the visionary group, you called it, that was at the Stakeholders Forum last May. So yourself and now Roy Barrett, who's the independent chair, and Gary Owens, who's the new CEO, are all from that group. Mm-hmm. Some might say that, you know, none of you have a mandate, none of you have got the voice of the grassroots of Irish football, none of you have come through any councils or any elections.
Yeah, which we think is actually a plus at this time. If we're going back to regain trust and credibility, we'd like to think that we'll come in with fresh ideas, fresh approach. And we recognise that there are great people with great heart in the game at all stations, but we obviously have a lot of work to do to make sure that the trust and credibility comes from outside that. So look, you could have easily picked people from within that sort of group of stakeholders and the various platforms that are in place in Irish football and work from them again. But I think where the last 12 months has gone, the narrative publicly has shown a complete lack of trust. And something new had to come in, and we're glad to provide that. But that's not to say, you know, that we don't recognise the goodness that's out there, you know, both in terms of volunteer level, grassroots level, etc. So we're very much aware that people will look at the three of us and say, what are they doing? But we hope, by virtue of the assistance that we think we'll get from the stakeholders, we hope that the way that we'll appease government for the future to maybe get even further funding as the future goes on, and that the game itself will have trust that things are being done properly at the top, that counteracts anybody's worries that the three of us are on some kind of mission to be just a gang like the old gang, you know. I think the great thing about this group, when it came together, funny enough, we were in here speaking to Marion Finucane, God be good to her, when I got texts from Gary Owens, for instance, saying, you know, immediately after show, I'd love to help. And so this isn't a bunch of pals from the old days coming together. This is just people who got together for the right reasons, who wanted to do this for a labour of love. And I think people will respect that and will treat that, you know, as probably better for the FAI right now than going into the old group.
That's my final point, Niall. Do you think that your appointment now, along with Gary and Roy Barrett, can convince government and the other stakeholders, the banks, UEFA, to assist the FAI financially in the short term?
Yeah, well, I hope so. We'll find out a little bit more on that in the coming weeks, I think. I'm confident that it'll be enough to give us a good stepping stone to get right back into action and do what we can. In the short to mid-term, can we, you know, prove that we're worth more? Can we get better investment? Can we attract the right type of sponsors? Can they regain the trust that's needed here? But I'll go back to my biggest point in all this. We are at nothing if we don't get it right with our own workforce, with our own servants who come in every day, who've lacked leadership and who have felt downtrodden at times. They're going to be our greatest advert of what football in this country can do, be it on the RDO level, that the coaches go out to schools, clubs, etc., be it on the elite coaches, the international managers. We have to show them that they're part of a vibrant association that can really go forward. We have to lead them and let them do the work. We can't just talk about it. So that's kind of why we're here. And if we do that, I think then all the other things will fall into place and government will see what we're capable of. It's going to be an ongoing process. I mightn't be here for all of it. Gary Owens mightn't be here for all of it. But one thing I do know, we will leave a structure. We hope that any legacy that we do leave will be signed off by the board, and whoever is in this position 6, 12, 18 months time, that they will put great things into play, and the FAI and the people within the FAI will be leading from the front.
Now that was Tony O'Donoghue, our soccer correspondent, speaking to Niall Quinn, and Tony has joined us on the line. Tony, just listening to him there, and when you think of the brief that you outlined and put to him, he has to focus on leading a future League of Ireland strategy, the overall development of the game, and then focus on helping, restoring and building key relationships. Is he the right man to do those jobs?
Well, I mean, I think that was a very impressive interview, I have to say. I think that he made his case very, very well. And as I mentioned before we played the interview, you know, his reputation within the game is superb. He's undoubtedly a man of integrity. And so there'll be some people probably within grassroots, perhaps. You know, I've mentioned before about football in this country. It's so full of sectional interests. Sometimes the first item on the agenda is the split. The fact that he won't have come through councils, won't have been elected, nor will Roy Barrett have been, nor will Gary Owens have been. Well, that'll be important to some people. But, you know, as I've mentioned before, I think the FAI is in a hole, and you know the first thing to do is stop digging. This is a massive crisis, and I think someone of the calibre of Niall Quinn to get involved at this stage now, I think it'll be good for the game.
Tony, he was incredibly honest when he was chatting to him, when he put it to him about, you know, you turning on that role. You kind of got the sense when he said saving the game is quite important to him. It's a passion for him. It's something. It's not just a job title. It's something he wants to put right.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the key point here is, like, why should government or the bank or UEFA trust the FAI? Why should they be given money? Because, you know, what we've seen and the stories that have come out and the investigations, some of which are ongoing, have shown an organisation that is not to be trusted with grant aid or sponsorship or revenue from various sources, TV money or what have you. So there's a lot of rebuilding of trust has to happen. And Niall Quinn is somebody, I think, that does give you a sense that you can trust him. I think he is very open. He is very honest. And it's refreshing, I think, in a way. So, yeah, it was an interesting chat, but as he'll be the first to tell you, you know, it's all very well to talk the talk. Now he's got to go and walk the walk.
And do you think he's learned from stuff like, you know, being chairman, like you mentioned, at Sunderland? He knows that he's the football person and he's right to be in that side of it and leave Gary Owens look after the other side.
Well, football, you know what, a lot of people, we're all football fans, but it's a business. You'll know from rugby, you know, professional sport is a business. And, you know, there's decisions that have to be made that Niall had to make. You know, he was even a one-time manager of Sunderland very briefly, and he realised that wasn't his role. So he seems to be aware of the things that he can do and the things that he can't do. Other people will have said that he's, you know, a lot of talk. That visionary group published their findings. It didn't seem to gain a huge amount of traction in the football world. But then again, as I say, what an extraordinary year we've had. And I think people, you know, have just been kind of knocked over like Skittles, wondering what time is the next statement coming out? When's the next crisis? And hopefully now with, as I say, the appointment of the independent directors, one more independent director still to be added, of course. And we would imagine that the government will have some say or be interested in that directorship being filled. So we do have an interim chief executive now, Gary Owens. We have an interim deputy chief executive. It'll be interesting to see the position of Paul Cook now. He was the interim lead. I mean, we've had four interim CEOs in the last 10 to 12 months. So, yeah, there's upheaval at Abbottstown. But there's an EGM on Saturday where Donal Conway, the president, will finally step down. There's a new president to be elected. It'll be either Gerry McEnany, formerly of the Defence Forces, or Martin Herity, former civil servant of Sligo Rovers, who's on the new FAI board. So, I mean, there's still plenty of room for the volunteer section, still plenty of room for democracy. But yeah, I think the game in Ireland, the administration of the game, desperately needs a shake-up, and I think we're in the middle of that now.
Tony O'Donoghue, RTE soccer correspondent, thanks for joining us.
FM. The Thursday Topic on Game On.
Now, with the Hula Hoops National Cup Finals looming, we have invited in some players to chat all things basketball. Jason Killeen joins us from Griffith College Temple Oak. Hilary Netz from DBSA. Now, they will face each other in the men's decider. And Mimi Clark from Pribal Colester, they will take on Singleton Super Value Brunel. Guys, you're all very, very welcome to Game On.
Thank you.
Jason, just with the cup finals coming up, we decided that we just have a chat and see where everything is at with basketball in Ireland. And for most people who follow basketball, you are one of the most recognisable faces in the sport. Can you just give us a little bit of an overview on the career that you've had so far? It's still going, I know, but you've had a pretty great one so far.
Yeah, still going, but in the twilight years now. Grew up in Limerick, Ireland, played there. I went to America on scholarship when I was 16. So I was lucky enough to get a scholarship to play in college there, graduated and played professional for 12 years after that, and currently working in Griffith College in Dublin while playing with the Super League team also.
Okay, well, just from knowing you, like you've made it sound almost like, you know, it was very quick, but you've been all over the place, like you've had a phenomenal career really.
Yeah, I've been really lucky in that regard. I got to see, you know, 40 different countries just from playing basketball, so I consider myself very lucky to get a chance to do that.
Mimi, what was your has your career been like so far?
Well, I've come from a big basketball family, so my mom and her brothers and sisters were all kind of founding members of Colester, so I kind of started off with Colester at a very young age, and was on the under 16 Irish team. Captained that, and then I was kind of unlucky to hit a phase where Basketball Ireland was in big debt, so there was no Irish teams for me to try out for until the senior women's team came back, and I was part of the 2016 senior women's team where we won silver in the European Championships for small countries in Gibraltar in 2016. Then I was lucky enough as well to get a full scholarship in DCU, and then followed that on to DIT, where I was able to study for free a master's in business and entrepreneurship. And then I kind of took a bit of a break and moved to the UAE for 2.5 years, and now I'm back for the final.
Bidding for glory. Yeah. Just during that time that you mentioned there, when things weren't great for Basketball Ireland, how did it affect you guys? We'll say, I know there wasn't any national teams, but just like as players, did it at any stage kind of put you off playing?
Not really. I had seen what it was like. My brother got to play on a lot of Irish teams before the kind of dip, but I suppose just kind of still having the competitiveness in the Super League, it was maybe a bit of a lull to do away with that. But they did try to do kind of Super League select teams where we went to. I actually missed my 6th year graduation because I was in Luxembourg with that one, a Super League select team. So they were kind of trying to fill that gap by having something there, but it was still, we still had the competitiveness of the league, so I suppose it didn't affect it too much, but it is great to have it now back.
It must, like when you think about how far it's come now to be playing for your country and winning things as well, like it's a huge achievement to get back there.
Yeah, absolutely. Especially hosting the under 18s back in 2017, it really grew basketball in the country, especially for the females of the country.
And it's growing all the time.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, Hilary, tell us a little bit about you. I know you moved from Zimbabwe when you were about 6. So when did basketball come into your life?
Unlike the other two here, basketball didn't really come into my life until I was 12. So the summer before first year, my brother brought me to an outdoor court playing street ball. And after that, I gave up hurling, soccer, and just dove straight into basketball.
What is it about basketball that made you go, right, this is the one for me?
It's not really one thing. It's just such an exciting sport. Training for it is exciting. Playing in front of people is exciting. And then just everyone who's involved in the sport just makes it a full experience that you just fall in love with.
So when you were young then, what was your dream? Like, what did you want to do and achieve in basketball?
Like everyone else, the dream was to play in the NBA, play professional basketball. But as you grow older and you realize where, you know, what kind of opportunities you can take, you realize that the NBA might not be the option, seeing as I'm not the tallest person on the basketball court. But I got my chance to play in Italy professionally, came back here, and I've been playing here ever since, and coaching as well, trying to get more people involved in the sport.
Jason, just for you, like, you know, when you've been I suppose around for a while, trying to find a nice way of putting it, but like most people that are listening in, like, they will remember basketball from the 80s, from the 90s, when like it was just phenomenal. It was a sport that everybody was interested in. Are those, do you have memories from then?
Yeah, well, I left when in 2001, 2002, so I would definitely have memories of the 90s with the, you know, the Limerick teams, Burger King Limerick and that. But, you know, seeing the sport grow over the past couple of years, like with I worked with Basketball Ireland for 5 years previous to my current job, and just to see the numbers growing is incredible, you know. And it's weekends like this at the Cup Final where there isn't any other sports really on TV and everyone tunes in to watch the game. The numbers are phenomenal. And for us, it's, you know, we're practicing two or three nights a week. We're playing every weekend. And then to get that chance to play on the big stage and to show the sport that we love to the rest of the country is very exciting.
And most people will have to watch it on TV because it's all sold out.
Yeah, 60 seconds, all the tickets were gone.
It's unbelievable, isn't it? So for you then, is that a mark of maybe basketball getting back on track again, getting back to where it needs to be, or at least kind of heading in that direction?
Yeah, I mean, like Hillary said there, the basketball community in Ireland is very close and tight-knit. Like any club you go to, you're welcome in, you know, and you'd know somebody on every team and everybody's kind of friends. And we enjoy that, and you know, the more the merrier really. So for us, I coach as well, everybody here coaches, everyone that's in the sport seems to want to give back to the sport and encourage people to get in. And I think that's a testament to what we know the sport can offer. You know, we talked about every kid's dream was the NBA, or in football every kid's dream is the Premier League. But when that dream goes away and the reality sets in, you really get a sense of what you can achieve through basketball. Like, I have a college degree, I have a master's degree, I was lucky enough to have friends from all over the world now, and it's all true basketball.
Mimi, the same for you really, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I suppose it's kind of what you put in, you get out. So a lot of the top players do kind of give back, and that's what I suppose we're pushing for in 2020 with increasing the female participation, because there's not too many female coaches around, and I think that'll be nice to see, hopefully by the end of this year, 20% higher coaching population being female.
That's the case in a lot of sports as well. It's not just isolated to basketball. But one thing I always noticed about the Cup Final weekend is that even though the men's and women's were on at the same time, I know they're on different days today, it didn't matter on the Monday morning about the men getting the front page or the back page. It was whoever was the better game. So, like, to be able to turn it over on a Monday and see, right, well, you know, one of the men's teams won by loads, wasn't a great game, but the women's game was really, really tight and it was a thriller. And then they get the back page that they deserve.
Yeah, it is a pity, but I suppose it's just kind of what comes with it. And hopefully that will change over the next coming years. But I suppose it's every year it's different. If the men's is a blowout, it's the women that you're talking about if that's a close mm-hmm. game, and vice versa. I suppose the kind of women take a bit of a dip if it's a case of they're the poorer game. But now looking forward to Sunday. We've played Brunel twice, and the last time we played them went to overtime, so hopefully it'll be more the same of that.
Another cracker. And Hillary, like, coaching, like, is it, do you find that there's a lot of girls playing basketball as well?
Yeah, I actually do like one-on-one sessions with a couple of Irish players that are girls, and I'd say the majority of the people that I coach are actually girls. And the more and more, like, you kind of see it online, see it on videos, whatever it is, the more people get involved.
Well, it's one of the few sports that has a 50-50 split with participation, so it's 50% female, 50% male, and I think that's something that Basketball Ireland is very proud of.
Just on the coaching and giving back, like, I know from being a little bit involved in basketball now with kids that a lot of the people that I see playing in the top teams at the weekend are then coaching the kids in the camps. Is that kind of a concerted effort made by the clubs to have a sustainable product and a sustainable league?
I think it's more of a happy outcome. Like, so when you get to that level, you realise how many people have helped you come along and get there. So it's, you know, it's a natural progression to turn around and try and help the next generation to come up as well.
Mimi?
And I suppose as well that if the top players are giving back and coaching the younger players, you want to see them at your games. So it kind of works hand in hand that if we're going to increase our audience, we need our own players to kind of support us as well as we support them.
Hilary, do you find that there's, when it is, I suppose, like, I know participation is quite big, but basketball is still a minority sport, that there's a really big responsibility on the players, the elite players, to kind of give back to the media, to be seen, to just go out and help promote their game?
Yeah, I think it's a major thing, especially in AINA at the moment. I'd say 6 or 7 of our Super League team are coaching from under 10s, the academy, which is like our 5 to 6 year olds, and then up to the under 16 level. So the more these kids can see the coaches that are playing in Super League level at the highest level in Ireland, the more that they want to play basketball and they want to do the things that we're doing on the court. So it just spurs that inspiration for them to join the sport.
I hope that none of my kids think they'll be able to do some of the things that you can do in the court yet anyway. So when we look at the like, you've got DBS AINA and you have Griffith College, Temple Oak, just Hilary, those connections with the colleges, how important are they?
I think they're really, really big. They're critical kind of things to have connections with the colleges, and I think there's a couple of other teams that do that in the country as well, and it really helps bring over the top talent from America or Europe or wherever it is to come play in the league. And then within that as well, it helps, you know, increase people's education. Like, for example, Mimi was in DCU. DCU and DIT. Jason got his education there as well. I'm in DBS at the moment studying on scholarship. So I think it's great to have a connection with the college.
And Jason, it must be great for the kids as well to see that pathway, and for the parents to know that, you know, if they stick at something, that there could be an education at the end of it.
Well, that's the ultimate goal. I mean, what's great about having the link with the colleges is, again, Hilary talking about coaching in the club, you know, and we watched a game on Saturday, you have people from Spain, America, Serbia, just probably 6 or 7 different countries, and the money to pay professional players isn't quite there in Ireland yet. So being able to go down a different route and bring over guys and girls that want to follow their education is key to kind of, it broadens out to a different market.
Is it the goal to get back to a place where professional players can be paid?
I think the goal is to keep growing and to see what happens when we do that.
And how do you push it on now even further, Jason?
Well, it's weekends like this. I mean, the last time we played AINA, it was a cracker of a game. Yeah. And it came down to, you know, it came down to the last minute. So they know what we can do and we know what they can do, and everyone will be scouting each other. And, you know, if the game is anything like it was the last time, I think it'll definitely encourage some kids to pick up the ball.
Hilary, for you, like, first time in a cup final, it's pretty unbelievable.
Yeah, to be honest, it's all come really fast to us after being relegated last year and then gaining promotion back to the Super League this year, and now we're in a National Cup final. It's just kind of surreal at the moment. You know, it's hard to grasp what's actually happening, but I think the best thing we can do is just get our feet back on the ground and get ready to face the other guys.
Dream season though so far.
Yeah, really big, really big dream season. We just hope to continue the momentum and hopefully stay up at the top.
And Jason, for you, 3rd cup in 5 years, so it's like trying to maintain that consistency. How do you do it?
Well, that's it. I mean, it's tough to do it week on week, but I think the cup is definitely different. We have a good core of guys there that would have been there for all of them cups, so I hope we'll rely on that experience this weekend.
And Hilary, I have you here, so I've got to ask, how difficult is it to deal with somebody like Jason? What height do you have, Jason?
6'10".
It's very difficult. He's 6'10", he's a strong guy. Just to get him out of the key is a task, especially for somebody like me. If I get caught in a mismatch with him, I'm in big trouble, so I'm most likely going to foul him and grab his arms and hope he doesn't make the basket.
Jason, are you enjoying it as much as you always did?
Definitely. It's the camaraderie you build with the group, you know. You're the cold nights and the wet nights and stuff, and everyone else is at home and you're heading out to practice. It's the bond that you get to build with the team, and then to be rewarded by playing in a cup final I mean, that's exactly where we want to be.
So just in terms of your week then, like, what's it like? How do you juggle everything?
Oh, there's a lot. Between work, coaching, playing, practicing, and then again on the weekend, it's, you know, it's definitely 6 out of 7 nights of the week you're out of the house doing something basketball related.
Mimi?
Well, it's a bit different for me now because I'm only just fresh back from the UAE, so life hasn't really set in yet.
So you're a professional basketballer right now?
Well, I said there's not many opportunities in life where you're going to be in a National Cup final and you're also going to be unemployed where you can just solely focus on the Cup. So I've absolutely taken that in my stride for the last 2 weeks and I've been really enjoying it so far.
So in your game, it's against Brunel and they lost last year. So I can imagine how much they're going to want to bounce back from that.
Absolutely. But we're also on a 15-year drought where the last time we were in a cup final, we kind of took it a bit for granted, tried to treat it like it was just another game. So we kind of let the moment go by without fully appreciating it. So we'll be ready to knuckle down on Sunday and hopefully bring it home this time.
And for people that are going to be watching it, what are the key matchups?
I suppose most people have been saying that our Americans and Brunel's Americans will kind of cancel each other out. So I suppose it then comes down to how much our Irish players step up against each other, as well as they have a European in Greta, who's, last time I checked, was shooting 50% from the three, which is huge. So she's a very fluid, natural shot, which will work really nice in the arena, unfortunately for us, but hopefully our shooters will be able to match her.
And Hillary, what are the key matchups going to be in your game?
For us, I'd say Jason right here and Mark Reynolds are our post player, and then the two Neils, Neil Lynch and Neil Randolph, probably the best shooters at the Super League level. There'll be a big matchup, and then of course Josh and Steph, and then D, and I cannot remember your other import's name.
Zabby.
Yeah. So there's going to be a big matchup with those guys. And then both teams really have a 1 to 12 that are solid players that match skill for skill. So it's like a 1 to 12 matchup, really. It's going to be a tough game.
Jason, just last word to you. Does the future look bright for Irish basketball?
Yeah, definitely. Mimi talked earlier about when Basketball Ireland went bankrupt that time and there was a lull. You know, I was in my early 20s at that time and was on the senior men's team, so you kind of feel hard done by. You miss all your prime years playing on the national team, but it is a relief now seeing the game grow constantly and seeing more and more kids get involved. And, you know, a part of that as well is I think every kid has a phone and you can turn on highlights, and basketball is there's a potential highlight every 24 seconds, and it's such a fast game that it transfers very easy to modern society, and that, and being able to turn on your phone and look at highlights. So seeing the game grow year on year it's a relief to see that. I think it's going to be in a good place for years to come.
And where do you think, like, where can you imagine basketball going in Ireland for you? Like, what would be like, I knew could get there?
Well, I think the top league is going to keep getting better and better. There's probably more Europeans playing in the Super League now than there's ever been, more than Americans. And it's just to keep the Irish players getting better and better. But that starts at the ground. And the more kids we can get involved playing at the under 9, under 10, under 11 age group, the better. And I think another big part of it is with the likes of the GAA and the IRFU and the FAI now, and they're seeing basketball for what it is and what it can offer their kids. You see an awful lot of GAA clubs are linking up with basketball clubs, so you have the kids playing GAA in the summer, you have them playing basketball in the winter, and the sports, they complement each other so well that you're constantly growing that base and that foundation of kids coming up.
So when you have a Michael Darragh McCauley or a Kieran Donaghy, you see that as a good thing?
Oh, absolutely, yes.
Okay, guys, thank you very, very much. Hilary Netz, Jason Killeen and Mimi Clark. So the two games are going to be on over the weekend on TG Cahir. So you have Griffith College Temple Oak taking on DBS Aina, and then you have Singleton Super Valley Brunel and Priabel Colester. And best luck to you all.
Thanks very much.
The man
open left. Game on, Iron America.
Time to turn stateside, and we're delighted to be joined by the sweetest thing to come out of America since the donut. Jeff Shepherd, how are you?
I'm great, Donners. How are you doing, man?
I'm great. It's a big weekend of basketball, and I know we chat football a lot, but we might start with basketball. Zion Williams, he had an impressive NBA start, 19 years of age, number one pick, playing with the Pelicans. He's been out injured. Is it 44 games? How did he get on?
Yeah, so he had a knee surgery right before the season started, and yeah, he missed, you know, basically kind of the first half of the season. He made his debut last night at home, the New Orleans Pelicans taking on the San Antonio Spurs. And, you know, it was almost kind of a tale of two halves when it came to Zion's performance. He struggled a little bit, wasn't really too much into the game plan. You know, look, they're monitoring his minutes because, I mean, he had knee surgery and they don't want him to, you know, risk another injury. And so I think he had maybe 4 points kind of midway through the fourth quarter. He had played maybe, I don't know, 10 minutes or something like that. And then he absolutely caught fire midway through the fourth quarter, and the Pelicans made a run. They had been trailing most of the game. He scored 17 straight points in about 3 minutes. Every possession down the floor for the Pelicans, he either hit a three or hit another bucket. He would go to the lane, you know, go hard in the lane, get the bucket to go in, and the building was just going absolutely bananas. And it was just an amazing glimpse. You know, he just literally flipped the switch, and all of a sudden, everything he did correctly. He could do no wrong for about 3 minutes. And again, 17 straight points that he scores. It was really a nice glimpse of this potential that he has, you know, in living up to what everyone thinks he can be.
Shep, his speech afterwards, or his interviews afterwards, were great. It was everything I dreamed of, except for the losing part.
Yeah, I mean, and that was the thing. I mean, you know, and he didn't want to come out of the game. The Pelicans coach, Alvin Gentry, took him out of the game with about 4 minutes to go, again, because they're resting his knee. They have him on a medical plan, you know, on how long he's going to play. They're working him into the lineup. They did not want him to go too long. They didn't want to hurt himself or anything like that. And he begged and begged to stay into the game. And actually, Lonzo Ball, the point guard, kind of waved off calling a timeout to keep him out here, keep him on the court for one more possession that he scored on. So, I mean, you know, the other teammates recognized what was going on as well. But, yeah, it was they were upset because they lost. But I think the team realizes the potential that's there once he's going to start playing, you know, 30, 35 minutes of ball game. They can take another step. They're on the outside right now looking into the playoff picture, but they're just a couple of games back from the last spot. And to quite honestly be there this long into the season without, you know, probably your best player or potentially your best player says a lot about the guys that have been, you know, what they've been doing, you know, while he's been injured.
Yeah, it's a brilliant thing to do with a younger player as well. You've got to remember with all the hype, he is only 19, but is momentum gathering around him now? Is there a big fuss about this guy stateside?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the thoughts are that he would be the guy to, you know, kind of take the baton from LeBron James. You know, if it's not Anthony Davis who was you know, LeBron's teammate, and then you've got Kawhi Leonard and Giannis, you know, kind of that next generation. But of the players that are, you know, 22 and younger, and the long term future of the game. Yeah, I mean, Zion is definitely considered to be, you know, the guy with the most upside and the best player out there.
So no pressure on him then to be the next LeBron James?
Yeah, none whatsoever.
I actually was reading as well that he, Joe Burrow, is going to be represented by the same agency as him as well. So two huge stars at CAA.
Yeah, so, you know, CAA, those guys could probably own many small islands in the Caribbean if they would like to. I mean, they typically represent, you know, quarterbacks and, you know, best players in the NBA. And, yeah, it was announced this week that that's where Joe Burrow was going to sign. And, you know, all signs are pointing to him, you know, being the number one overall pick and going to Cincinnati back in his home state of Ohio. So the NFL draft will be, you know, in April. So he still have a couple of more months of working out. But it seems to be all but written in stone that Burrow is going to be the number one overall pick.
Yeah, we're heading into Super Bowl, but before we kind of look at that, Eli Manning hanging up the boots. What's going on there, Shep?
Yeah, so, you know, the kind of the first name in American football is Manning. You know, you've got Archie Manning, the father who played for the Saints and the Vikings in the 70s and 80s. and then his sons, Peyton and Eli. You know, Peyton won 2 Super Bowls, one with the Colts, one with the Broncos before retiring a couple of years ago. And then the youngest brother, Eli, became the New York Giant in 2004 and announced yesterday that he's going to be retiring. There's a formal ceremony, I believe, scheduled tomorrow in New York. But he was the starting quarterback. He only played for the New York Giants, which is rare, you know, in American sports these days to really be with one franchise. But there are a lot of really interesting debates about kind of where Eli sits, you know, just kind of in the whole world of professional football and the quarterback position. Get this, his record when he retires, the Giants won 117 games when he started, and they lost 117 games when he started. So he was a 500 quarterback over whatever that is, you know, 15 years. Of course, he will always be remembered for they beat the Patriots twice in the Super Bowl. In 2007, the famous game where they ended the Patriots' opportunities to go 18-0 to be the, you know, the first team to ever go 18-0, and the amazing throw to David Tyree and then the touchdown pass to Plaxico Burress. And then they upset the Patriots again 2 years later. He was 8-4 in the playoffs. You know, he started 210 consecutive games, I believe. You know, he was never injured. He never missed a game due to an injury. I mean, he was always there, but you just never really knew what you were going to get. And again, 117 and 117. It's just a fascinating number. After that many years, you could be a 500 quarterback.
Yeah, that is incredible. Shep, what's a formal retiring ceremony? I feel shortchanged here. What's going to happen?
Well, so they'll have a press conference, and, you know, some folks will get up and talk, and then Eli will obviously make the announcement, and, you know, he'll deal with the press. And look, again, it's New York, so, you know, everything's going to be blown out of proportion. But, you know, they'll officially, I would assume they'll retire his jersey at some point. I mean, again, you know, they won 2 Super Bowls, over the last decade or, you know, 15 years or whatever it is. And so, I mean, it's hard to not look at him and say, you know, he's had an incredibly successful career. But again, you get to the wins and losses, it's even. But then there's also this number, too. All total, he made more than $250 million playing football, which is the most in NFL history. So I'd say he's probably pretty happy.
He's making money angels at this party.
Shep, we could talk numbers with you all night, but I'm afraid that is all we have time for. It is finished for myself and Donika for tonight.
Oh, we didn't even get to chat about United.
No, but we will tomorrow night with Alan Cawley.
Oh yes, he will be seeding.
Cara Stewart is up next.